for immigrants to be here, and it's very difficult for them to come here right now.
Yeah, and I think that's the crux of where we have a lot of our agreement. That, you know, I think we both agree it should be easier to come here. You know, I definitely hold the sentiment that it is a good thing to have immigrants in this country. I mean, I wouldn't be here right now if it weren't for the fact that my grandparents came here as recently as the 1960s. So, you know, I definitely have.
Yeah. Neither of us are Native Americans, I don't think. I don't think most of the people listening are 100% Native Americans, so we're all immigrants.
And I think, you know, kind of where the thing I wanted to kind of zero in on is, you know, you bring up the point of, say, you know, a mother who steals bread. You know, we show compassion in those cases where we review the violation of the law. I'm curious, to what extent do we provide, say, slaps on the wrist, because I mean, you know, you're still talking about, irrespective of the fact that, you know, potentially there's a moral good or even maybe a moral ambiguity, you know, there is a law that's broken, and I think that's, you know, the kind of the key core and principle thing here. To what extent do you exercise grace, and to what extent do you go about the upholding of the law? So I mean, you know, there it's a lot to kind of touch on, but unfortunately we cap ourselves to 30 minutes here, and you know, restrain the you know, free flow of intellectual debate. But I know, you know, there was the one thing that you wanted to get to, and I definitely want to make sure we had some time to speak about it. You wanted to speak about gender. You know, I would assume this is of a broad sort of heady general what do we think here, but I'm getting, is there something specifically that you wanted to touch on?
So this is for a class project of mine, obviously. So I wanted to get your opinion on this. So there's this sort of model of three different models of marriage. So there's this idea of a traditional marriage. This is what you imagine, like the housewife. You know, the wife typically doesn't work. If she does, it's like maybe a part-time job. She does the majority of the housework, the majority of taking care of kids. And then there is this neo-traditional model. Let's hold that thought. Let's go to the opposite end. There's this progressive model where this is what, like, a very egalitarian person would advocate all marriage should look like. You know, equal, both the mother and the father are breadwinners. You know, they might have roughly equal incomes, and they split housework, they split caring for the kids equally amongst them. And then there's this neo-traditional model, which is a bit of a mix of the two, of this. Basically, the mother does work, but she also does the brunt of the housework, of the taking care of the kids. And I wonder, of those three models of marriage, which of those would sound the most appealing to you? Which of those you believe not our society should be structured on, but which do you believe you would want your ideal marriage to look like?
Oh, this is interesting. We're breaking from the politics here on the show, which is cool, I guess.
Let's say scaling it down to a microscopic level.
I guess we can say that. I mean, listen, I'm in many ways, I'm an old school guy. You know, that's just the kind of world I grew up in. More often than not, the type of people of my background gravitate towards the neo-traditional in a lot of ways. Because I think this is also informed in a lot of ways by my faith. I definitely think, you know, as a Catholic, you know, there's this, in conception of marriage, we define, you know, separate but equally important roles for both the man and the woman in the relationship. And I think, you know, this is kind of the thing that's lost on a lot of people when they look at the Catholic or, you know, even generally Christian conceptions of marriage between a man and a woman, because it's, you know, obviously there are certain things that both the man and the woman have going on for their respective roles in the marriage, but they are of equal importance, and there's equal accountability between both halves to hold up their end of the bargain. I don't think that the neo-traditional model really deviates much from that, from the traditional, in so much as it still maintains kind of the core essence of what's going on, with some, you know, realities that kind of reflect back on potentially some of the socioeconomic factors we have to kind of put into consideration for a lot of families that are currently trying to make ends meet and need to live on two incomes. I mean, I can tell you it's definitely not easy in New York to afford to live there, when the median households the median house price selling in my home county is almost $750,000. It's ludicrous. So, you know, I can say that I would kind of bounce between the two. But, you know, obviously as a libertarian, so long as you're not hurting other people, I'm very much of the opinion that you, you know, pursue the model that works for you. But I'm curious then, you know, is there any kind of further consideration from that you wanted to touch on? Or if, I mean, where you personally kind of fall on that? Where does that kind of pan out for you?
So for me personally, obviously, I'm a very progressive person, so I think I that's the type of model I would want. I would want sort of shared responsibility, both parents having relatively equal status, income levels, and this is sort of the environment I was raised in. My parents, sometimes some would lean a little bit more, but generally, I feel like both my mom and my dad had a very big role in raising me. So I'm curious, you said that in your faith, both the men and the women have these separate but equally important roles. So I'm curious, what would you conceive as the role for the man in a marriage?
I mean, he's the primary provider, you know, mm-hmm. This kind of falls back into, you know, sure, there can be, you know,
so like kind of this breadwinner role.
Yeah. And you know, at the same time, you know, the woman, you know, can, and she has the desire to do so, should pursue, you know, a source of income as well. But, you know, the conception is, you know, that there's the primary role in the part of the man to do so, being kind of the ultimate defender of the family, things of that sort, you know, which is mirrored in a lot of ways by the nature of both men and women in just kind of how the there's a kind of attitude of what manhood is and what womanhood is that's presented through the Bible, which mm-hmm. you know, it doesn't mean that it's kind of cut and dry, this is the case. I mean, you know, obviously we're not, you know, from the perspective of faith, we're all made in God's image, but we have varieties upon which that is different. But, you know, there's kind of broad generalizations that encompass certain deviations as well that just are brought forth by the Bible. And I did actually do a very interesting Bible study a while back on, you know, mm-hmm. what does the Bible say about manhood? What does it mean to be a man? What are the virtues inherent to masculinity? We're kind of in the last minute here. I mean, any kind of closing thoughts there that you wanted to bring in?
No, this has been really, really great. A good conversation, I'd say.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't know if you feel the same way.
Absolutely, yeah. I think, you know, it's always so crazy how fast the time goes. You know, it is.
Yeah, I was very surprised about that.
it makes you yearn for the days of ye old tavern. You know, the coffee, whatever you wanted, the salon. But anyways, thank you for coming on. It was a pleasure to have you, and I hope you guys enjoyed having, you know, an actual guest on the show once again. But I'll send you all off with this. You all have a wonderful rest of your day. Take care, and God bless.
I need answers to my tax questions. Where can I find them?
Need answers? Try our interactive tax assistant on irs.gov/ITA. Simply select your tax questions, provide your information, and it gives you answers. Also, check our help and resources page and try our online tax map. 5,000 tax topics from A to Z. Plus, you can access forms, publications, in a variety of formats.
I need answers to my tax questions. Where can I find them?
Need answers? Try our interactive tax assistant on irs.gov/ITA. Simply select your tax questions, provide your information, and it gives you answers. Also, check our help and resources page and try our online tax map. 5,000 tax topics from A to Z. Plus, you can access forms, publications, in a variety of formats.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Techno Land? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
RCT 88.3 FM. My name's Anthony Cachado, and you're listening to The Angry Young Man. Now, before we get into the mix of things today, just wanted to let you guys know that everything that you're going to hear today is strictly the opinions of myself and my guests today, and don't necessarily represent the views of WRCT. We're back. We're actually doing new episodes. I promise this is a thing. We're making it happen. And we have a guest today. We're actually talking about something interesting, or a couple interesting things today. We have a longtime friend of mine, hailing from Texas. We have Gavin here with us today. Welcome to The Angry Young Man.
Hello.
Yeah, so I had a couple things that would be interesting for us to talk about. I know there was something you wanted to talk about, but I've been reading what some may call the book of the year so far. I'm reading Abundance by Ezra Klein.
I have a copy of that.
You have a copy of that? I just now got a copy because they had, ironically, Abundance was not abundant for a period of time. I just got a copy of it. It's interesting because, you know, if for those of you who have listened to the show before, you'll know that I have a little bit of a fixation with housing. But it's interesting to see, you know, this argument for abundance liberalism and talking about using state capacity to kind of pursue growth and look at these things. I've only gotten about 30 pages into it so far. There's some things that I agree with. There's some things I disagree with. But I guess we'll start off this segment by kind of getting at that. I mean, Gavin, would you consider yourself an abundance liberal?
I'm not. I don't know. I guess I agree with the idea. I don't know.
I mean,
how would you define abundance liberal? And we'll go from there.
Well, I find it kind of the defining factor that separates it, the abundance liberal from, say, you know, the free market absolutist or fundamentalist, is the idea that there's a necessity to use state capacity to go after both supply and demand. They look at it as, and they open in the book by saying that, you know, for so long, because the fundamental kind of crux of economics is supply and demand, how it's been divided in half, and each side of the political spectrum has kind of made one of those their baby, in the sense that the right has been entirely supply focused and the left has been entirely demand focused. The lack of understanding that both have their own importance, because they are supply and demand, not just supply or just demand. They kind of advocate for the pushing of both to go about things. I mean, I have my fair share of disagreements kind of going out the gate with some of the claims, specifically as they relate to using state capacity to push for a lot of these things or to subsidize demand. Or look for some of those things. They may be addressed later in the book. I haven't gotten just far into it just yet. But I mean, I'm curious, to what degree do you subscribe to those sorts of claims? And if so, what's your critique of say the market fundamentalist approach that I'm sure you know you're aware that I hold on this matter?
Yeah, I'd say in all things in housing, which is our first topic, in food and water, there we have, I guess, the title of the book, we already have a superabundance of all of these things. We have enough where if we had the perfect allocation of resources, a perfect system, nobody would ever starve, because we have more food than anyone could eat. We have more housing. We have more homes than homeless people. All of these things. So we're at a point now where it's not really a matter of how do we grow food? How do we have more houses? How do we have enough for everyone to survive, which is what most of human history was about. And we now are at a point of, okay, how do we think about our systems to have them structured in such a way that everyone has enough? And I think that's kind of where we should be going forward as a society at this point. So especially in terms of housing, I don't think we should accept homeless people as a concept at all. And if that means somebody has like a homeless shelter, that's like a little studio apartment, then that's what that is. I think you should be given the bare minimum. And I think beyond that, if you want to work for something harder, absolutely. Like even, and this is where I'm going to lose people, but like even if you're like a drug addict and you want to be in your home all day doing drugs, I don't think you should have a particularly good quality of life. I don't think, because you're not contributing to society at all. But I don't think it's very ethical to say somebody should die in that circumstance, just should be on the street and have no societal support. And it's not even like an ethical thing. Like, homeless people are a drain on society as they exist. If they overdose, that's a drain on our medical system. If they live in like a northern climate, Pittsburgh, whatever, and it's the winter and they have pneumonia or frostbite or whatever. I don't know. I'm from Texas, so I don't know what happens when you get cold. It's a mystery. That's also a drain on the medical system. If they do a crime because they're so desperate and hungry and they have to go to prison, that's a drain on our prison system. So I think overall, you can even make an argument that just housing these people would be a cost-saving measure for society, for taxpayers overall. So that's sort of my position.
So, I mean, one of the kind of key things I want to zone in on, no pun intended, is... you know, you mentioned, you know, the crisis of homelessness, and something that they bring up very quickly in their section on at the outset is this idea of, you know, why do we have homelessness? Why does this happen? You know, they kind of zone in on the fact that more often than not, it's a cost issue, you know, in terms of how much the homes cost. And you know, in a lot of ways, I don't necessarily agree that we have enough housing or an abundance of housing. You know, at least in our metropolitan areas, there's not an abundance in the sense that we're able to address the massive demand of these areas. You look at states like California and New York that have been historically and notoriously bad at trying to address these issues with their zoning policies. I mean, you can drag in redlining if you really wanted to, but you know, it kind of falls down on this issue of there's this strand of liberal policy which has attempted to restrict supply, and as a result has caused the crisis of homelessness, because all of these other things that we look at as a result, where you have the drug epidemic as a result, or turning to violence, these are symptoms of the problem, not necessarily the problem in of themselves. So, I mean, at least coming from the my part of things, you know, you can address the cost issue at no cost by pulling back on a lot of these regulations that states like California and New York have been putting so much effort into holding up, and or at least have felt the pressure from the NIMBYs in their respective communities to uphold these regulations, which, quite frankly, it doesn't really cost anything materially outside of maybe the administrative cost of just kind of keeping the lights on while you're debating it. You know, for you to roll back these things, and you already experience so much change from there that, you know, it's an ambiguous amount of change. You know, how much are you going to make a dent in the homeless population? How much are housing prices going to fall down? But you could look at some pretty good case examples. You know, in your home state of Texas, I believe it was Austin that just recently saw rents tumble about 20% because the housing stock went up. You know, and that's it ultimately falls down to, you know, can you allow the market to address demand? I mean, if you're getting rid of these artificial caps, that should do enough in of itself. And then you kind of ask the question, well, is it necessary for us to start subsidizing demand again on your front of things? It would appear that your position, to an extent, requires some amount of subsidizing demand, or you know, doing some sort of subsidy to allow for access to housing. So I'm curious if that, you know, how that would play out, and to what degree the government or state capacity to act would be necessary if you were able to pull back on just the caps on supply.
Yeah, so just to re-clarify my position, like, obviously right now, like, there is a lot of cities where the housing situation is so far not great, not conducive to, like, universal housing. You know, how do I put this? Like you were saying, like, rents are exorbitantly high in Los Angeles and New York. But I think my position is this is not like a human economic. Like, we have the labor capacity, we have the technology to build enough homes for everyone to live. Just simply, just as simple as that. So then the question becomes, why don't we have that? And yeah, I think you adequately addressed some of these issues. A lot of it, well, all of it is just policy issues, basically. Some of it might be like cultural or whatever, but I feel like the vast majority is policy. These are policy decisions that are very deliberately put in place. A lot of it is like the YIMBY-NIMBY debate. We know. I was going to bring up Austin myself because it's an example I'm well aware of. It's right in my neighborhood, so to speak. You know, Austin has grown so much. You can look at a skyline picture of, like, Austin in 2015 versus Austin today, and it's like, it looks like a different city. And this isn't like because nobody wants, like rents are also super low in Austin. And there's, like, two sides of that. There's supply and demand. And one might be tempted to say, well, nobody wants to live in Austin, but that's just not the case. You know, you ask anybody in Houston,
Dallas, do you want to live in Austin?
I'd like to. Like, everyone wants to live in Austin. Austin's the cool place to live. It's like the LA of Texas. Like, people want to go there. So it's clearly not like a low demand thing. It's, they're doing something right. I think they've enacted good policies. Houston has done similar things. They have very, very notoriously soft zoning policies. So there's that, obviously. And yeah, I think you would have to have a very strong state capacity if you wanted to, like, provide a universal layer of guaranteed homelessness. But I think it is possible. I think a really good example of this is Japan. Japan is a country of how, like, almost a billion people, right?
A good amount.
I don't know.
Not off the, yeah. I don't know off the top of my head, but yeah, you, so.
Maybe like, okay, 100 million. Okay, not nearly as much as I thought, but.
A lot of people. We'll, the thing we'll is, put it that way.
They have in their entire country about 2,000 homeless people. And this is like in Tokyo. Like if there was a city in the size in the if there was a city the size of Tokyo in the U.S., there would be like a bajillion homeless people. So clearly, like Japan is doing something right. And I think a big thing is that they have a pretty generous a welfare system there. That kind of just doesn't accept homelessness as this thing. And I think a lot of it in Japan is also a cultural thing. Like this culture of there's a very, very strong stigma around homelessness and also like around hospitality. But I think a lot of it is like statewide decisions on the part of a government to support like very strong housing policies, because Tokyo is another place that has notoriously very low rents for a city of its size.
Well, I think you can look
and
at
Tokyo also has very, very, you know, not great houses, but like these tiny, tiny little condos that people have.
Yeah, and that's
I think
kind of...
that's fine. That's great. That beats living on the street.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of things that I would want. I would want like not a great quality of housing. Because obviously like cost is a worry, but like anything's better than people living on the streets.
Yeah.
So if there's a way to do this with like it being entirely free market, I would like that. But so far I haven't seen a good case of this being done like entirely through market forces and market incentives. So just to go back to your question, yeah, I think you would have to have a pretty strong government program for this to work.
I guess the one thing, and I will kind of pivot from there, is, you know, in the case of Japan, they have extreme, especially Tokyo, extreme density, which allows, uh-huh. you know, is a supply thing. They have enormous supply.
Sure.
I mean, maybe it's not the best supply. You mentioned that, you know, they're not the best apartments, but it's supply nevertheless, which allows, you know, rents to go down like that. But, you know, there's a lot to consider, I guess, very briefly, because I know there's a bigger topic we want to get to. While we're on the topic of other nations, you know, immigration never ceases to be a topic of interest. I know we have very many overlapping positions on this, but I guess the thing I wanted to probe you on a little bit was, as it relates to... The illegal nature of crossings, you know, be it for someone who's, you know, either of ill intent or not, I guess, you know, because we definitely agree, you know, there needs to be reform in the system as it relates to making it easier to immigrate. But as it relates to people who do come illegally, if you do go about treating it as a criminal offense, being that it you know it is a crossing that is not legal, so I'm curious to probe your thoughts on that, especially being from a border state. Kind of very briefly, what you think?
I have to organize my thoughts for a second. Sorry. I feel like when we call it like this illegal, like it moralizes it a lot that they've done some big crime. And I just don't see illegal things as necessarily morally bad things. You know, you can imagine a situation like a mother stealing food for her starving kids. I don't see that as morally bad. And a lot of the times this illegal immigration is a similar thing. It's these people in very, very desperate situations, so desperate that like I can't even imagine having to make some of these decisions. I know in the case of a very famous case recently of I'm not sure exactly what his name is. I think it's Kilmar Abrego Garcia.
It's the Venezuelan gentleman.
El Salvadorian.
We're jumping between El Salvador and Venezuela so much right now in the news.
Yeah,
get the streams crossed. But yes.
he was he was coming to the United States because a gang back in El Salvador was threatening the life of him and his family. And he came here and he worked in the United States. He has a pretty good paying job. He's contributing to the economy. He's paying taxes. He's buying local goods. He has a family. He has a wife who's an American citizen. He has kids here. And even though, yes, he came here illegally originally, I'm not comfortable saying he's any less American than you and me. And so it's sort of a case-by-case basis like that. If they're coming here to do terrible things, then obviously I'm not happy with that. If they're here to do crimes, if they're here to smuggle drugs, that's not great. But I don't think that's the vast majority of the people who are being deported right now. So I think you'd have to deal with that on a case-by-case basis, decide, is this person well integrated in the American society and the American economy? Are they contributing to our economy? And did they come here under a situation of distress? I think those are all considerations you have to make in these cases. And I think more often than not, I would like these people to stay here because it is a good thing for immigrants to be here, and it's very difficult for them to come here right now.
Yeah, and I think that's the crux of where we have a lot of our agreement. That, you know, I think we both agree it should be easier to come here. You know, I definitely hold the sentiment that it is a good thing to have immigrants in this country. I mean, I wouldn't be here right now if it weren't for the fact that my grandparents came here as recently as the 1960s. So, you know, I definitely have.
I mean, yeah. Neither of us are Native Americans, I don't think. Imagine. I don't think most of the people listening are 100% Native Americans, so we're all immigrants.
And I think, you know, kind of where the thing I wanted to kind of zero in on is, you know, you bring up the point of, say, you know, a mother who steals bread. You know, we show compassion in those cases where we review the violation of the law. I'm curious to what extent do we provide, say, slaps on the wrist, because I mean, you know, you're still talking about, irrespective of the fact that, you know, potentially there's a moral good or even maybe a moral ambiguity, you know, there is a law that's broken, and I think that's, you know, the key core and principal thing here. To what extent do you exercise grace, and to what extent do you go about the upholding of the law? So I mean, you know, it's a lot to kind of touch on, but unfortunately we cap ourselves to 30 minutes here, and you know, restrain the you know, free flow of intellectual debate. But I know, you know, there was the one thing that you wanted to get to, and I definitely want to make sure we had some time to speak about it. You wanted to speak about gender. You know, I would assume this is of a broad sort of heady general what do we think here, but I'm getting, is there something specifically that you wanted to touch on?
So this is for a class project of mine, obviously. So I wanted to get your opinion on this. So there's this sort of model of three different models of marriage. So there's this idea of a traditional marriage. This is what you imagine, like the housewife. You know, the wife typically doesn't work. If she does, it's like maybe a part-time job. She does the majority of the housework, the majority of taking care of kids. And then there is this neo-traditional model. Let's hold that thought. Let's go to the opposite end. There's this progressive model where this is what like a very egalitarian person would advocate all marriage should look like. You know, equal, both the mother and the father are breadwinners. You know, they might have roughly equal incomes, and they split housework, they split caring for the kids equally amongst them. And then there's this neo-traditional model, which is a bit of a mix of the two, of this. Basically, the mother does work, but she also does the brunt of the housework, of the taking care of the kids. And I wonder of those three models of marriage, which of those would sound the most appealing to you? Which of those do you believe not our society should be structured on, but which do you believe you would want your ideal marriage to look like?
Oh, this is interesting. We're breaking from the politics here on the show, which is cool, I guess.
Let's say scaling it down to a microscopic level.
I guess we can say that. I mean, listen, I'm in many ways I'm an old school guy. You know, that's just the kind of world I grew up in. More often than not, the type of people of my background gravitate towards the neo-traditional in a lot of ways. Because I think this is also informed in a lot of ways by my faith. I definitely think, you know, as a Catholic, you know, there's this in conception of marriage, we define, you know, separate but equally important roles for both the man and the woman in the relationship. And I think, you know, this is kind of the thing that's lost on a lot of people when they look at the Catholic or, you know, even generally Christian conceptions of marriage between a man and a woman, because it's, you know, obviously there are certain things that both the man and the woman have going on for their respective roles in the marriage, but they are of equal importance, and there's equal accountability between both halves to hold up their end of the bargain. And I don't think that the neo-traditional model really deviates much from that, from the traditional, in so much as it still maintains kind of the core essence of what's going on, with some, you know, realities that kind of reflect back on potentially some of the socioeconomic factors we have to kind of put into consideration for a lot of families that are currently trying to make ends meet and need to live on two incomes. I mean, I can tell you it's definitely not easy in New York to afford to live there, when the median households the median house price selling in my home county is almost $750,000. It's ludicrous. So, you know, I definitely I can say that I would kind of bounce between the two. But, you know, obviously as a libertarian, so long as you're not hurting other people, I'm very much of the opinion that you, you know, pursue the model that works for you. But I'm curious then, you know, is there any kind of further consideration from that you wanted to touch on? Or, if, I mean, where you personally kind of fall on that? Where does that kind of pan out for you?
So for me personally, obviously, I'm a very progressive person, so I think that's the type of model I would want. I would want sort of shared responsibility, both parents having relatively equal status, income levels. And this is sort of the environment I was raised in. My parents, sometimes some would lean a little bit more, but generally I feel like both my mom and my dad had a very big role in raising me. So I'm curious, you said that in your faith, both the men and the women have these separate but equally important roles. So I'm curious, what would you conceive as the role for the man in a marriage?
I mean, he's the primary provider, you know, and mm-hmm. this kind of falls back into, you know, sure, there can be, you know,
so like kind of this breadwinner role.
Yeah, and you know, at the same time, you know, the woman, you know, can, and if she has the desire to do so, should pursue, you know, a source of income as well. But you know, the conception is, you know, that there's the primary role in the part of the man to do so, being kind of the ultimate defender of the family, things of that sort, you know, which is mirrored in a lot of ways by the nature of both men and women in just kind of how the there's a kind of attitude of what manhood is and what womanhood is that's presented through the Bible, which mm-hmm. you know, there it doesn't mean that it's kind of cut and dry, this is the case. I mean, you know, obviously we're not, you know, from the perspective of faith, we're all made in God's image, but we have varieties upon which that is different. But you know, there's kind of broad generalizations that encompass certain deviations as well that just are brought forth by the Bible. And I did actually do a very interesting Bible study a while back on what does the Bible say about manhood? What does it mean to be a man? What are the virtues inherent to masculinity? We're kind of in the last minute here. I mean, any kind of closing thoughts there that you wanted to bring in?
No, this has been really, really great. A good conversation, I'd say.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't know if you feel the same way.
Absolutely, yeah. I think, you know, it's always so crazy how fast the time goes. You know, it is.
Yeah, I was very surprised about that.
it makes you yearn for the days of ye old tavern, you know, the coffee. Coffee, whatever you wanted, the salon. But anyways, thank you for coming on. It was a pleasure to have you, and I hope you guys enjoyed having, you know, an actual guest on the show once again. But I'll send you all off with this. You all have a wonderful rest of your day. Take care, and God bless.
This is McGruff the Crime Dog with an important message. Before you think about buying counterfeit products, think again. You're smart, buy smart, go for real. Learn more at McGruffPSA.org. This message is brought to you by the United States Patent and Trademark Office and the National Crime Prevention Council.
Sheridan Daniels. You're listening to my buddy, Eric Jackson Lurie, on WRCT 88.3 FM.
WRCT 88.3 FM, streaming online at WRCT.org. You're listening to the Christmas edition 2024 of Courts in Session, heard here every Thursday night from 8 to 10:30, rock and roll, country, and soul. Whereas we're doing it this week, Christmas rock and roll, country, and soul.